This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Bill Dorman, and this morning for Catherine Cruz. This week, a group of investors and entrepreneurs from around the Asia-Pacific are gathering in Honolulu. Some will be looking to pitch ideas. Others are ready to offer some financial backing. It's the fifth annual East Meets West Conference, put together by local company Blue Startups, and its managing partner, Shenoa Farnsworth, joins us this morning. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning.
And an opportunity for entrepreneurs to meet potential investors, also an opportunity to see the broader world, really, of cross-border investment. And why is that significant, and why is that significant in particular for Hawaii?
Yeah, we really believe Hawaii has this golden opportunity to be the place where East meets West for business. We've been the place where East meets West for culture, for tourism, for a lot of things historically, but we're really trying to draw those connections in the business world. We think that is a very unique opportunity that Hawaii has in the startup world in particular. There's a lot of activity right now in Asia in startups and a lot of activity on the mainland right now in startups. So this is a perfect meeting place for both of those communities, and they're very interested in what's happening at the other side. Silicon Valley, of course, the epicenter of this industry, very interesting to our Asian friends. And it's a great opportunity to showcase what's happening right here in Hawaii and open some eyes to the possibility that this is startup paradise, not just a paradise of beaches and palm trees.
So that theme, though, as Hawaii as connector of East and West, this has been around for a while.
It has.
And sort of the idea of it seems like sometimes we're seeing the start of the same movie of, oh, totally. Now we're going to get some more traction. Totally. Now we're going to get. Yeah. So how are we doing on the traction front?
Yeah, I hear you. And it is the reason we started this event, because we kept, again, talking about it. And I feel like I've been in this industry now in Hawaii for over 20 years, and we've been talking about it the whole time. And we really felt like, okay, no more lip service. We need to put some real tangible thing around this talk. So bringing people together and actually having them physically meet each other and network is the first step, we believe. And we're building that connective tissue that way. We have now a group of people who come to this event every year. They're really dedicated to it. They love this event, and they come from all over the world. And that group grows every year as well. And they're spreading the word about what's happening here in Hawaii out there in the world. So it's really interesting. I travel a lot for work, right, for Blue Startups. When I'm in Asia, I'm often talking to people who have heard of East Meets West, even if they've never heard of Blue Startups, even if they've never had previously thought of Hawaii that way. They go, yeah, I hear there's some things happening out there. I've heard this phrase, startup paradise. They've oftentimes heard that, and they've most often heard East Meets West. So it slowly changes the kind of mindset about what's possible here and what, you know, we are about as a business community here.
We'll get back to that in a second. And the phrase accelerator comes to mind. But that also, you are an accelerator. TechCrunch ranks you as one of the top 20 in the country. So explain a little bit about what an accelerator is, what you do, and how that, particularly in Hawaii, how you do what you do.
Right. So we are, an accelerator is a investor and mentorship program combined. Mm-hmm. So we provide seed funding for a group of companies at a time. We call it a cohort. So we work with up to 10 companies at a time. They're with us for 3 months. It is a residential program. So people are actually in our office space every day with us working together. We have 120 mentors in our network that come in and work with these companies while they're with us for the 3 months. So the idea is that we're not just providing capital, we're providing capital plus plus, right? So connections, network, and mentorship. And with that whole package, we're able to accelerate the growth of these companies significantly. And we've had some really big wins come out of Blue Startups so far. We've been in business now for almost 6 years. And our very first cohort, we've got some companies that are maturing very well. Volta Charging, which you may have seen around town.
Sure.
That started at Blue Startups in our first cohort. Also, Flow Water, which is a refillable water bottle station,
right. Mm-hmm.
Also started at Blue Startups. So those companies are some standouts, but we have now invested in 76 companies through that program. So again, connecting the dots, one of the things we looked at when we started Blue Startups, what's unique to Hawaii? How do we compete globally? right? If we're looking at, for example,
that's a big one.
Yeah. A startup has the opportunity to go to Silicon Valley, the opportunity to go to New York, Austin, many other places around the world. Why choose Honolulu? And one of the main reasons that we think you choose Honolulu is that access to Asia piece. If you have a business where you're doing your work in both markets, East and West, it makes sense to do that from here.
Historically, Hawaii's had a bit of a problem of you get the company started, you get to a certain level, and then it's time to go. And I realize that there are a lot of factors involved with this.
Yeah.
I've heard in terms of education, I've heard in terms of workforce skills,
yeah.
Access to capital is part of that. But what's your view on that? And again, what will it take to shift that to the next level?
Right. We believe what it takes is success, right? Success begets success. So the more we have companies that are staying here and are growing here, the more other companies will look to that and go, okay, we can do it too.
Hmm.
And that is going to require a little bit of, willpower to begin with. So a great example of that would be a company called Hobnob. So Hobnob was founded by a woman named Tina Fitch. She's one of our mentors. But she's a second-time founder, and this is really important because her first company, Switchfly, she started here, moved it to San Francisco because she felt she had to, grew it to, I think, 700 employees, something like that, a very large company. She left the company and came back home and has started her second company now called Hobnob, which is a high-tech app company. That company, she's determined to keep here, and she can do that because she already has those connections. She's built up that network. So she has an opportunity to build a company here that a first-time founder may not have. And that's really what we're trying to get to. We're trying to get to that place where our founders have that ability. Maybe it's not their first rodeo, or maybe they've gone through Blue Startup, so they have that leg up and that advantage and how to do that startup phase so that they can stay here longer. We understand it's a long-term process. Nothing's going to like change overnight.
Sure.
And right now it is still a challenge for companies to grow up here. We are seeding a bunch of companies all the time, and that's the first step. That's the important first step. But I think it will take, a decade or more for our companies to have everything they need right here at home.
And in the meantime, so Hank Rogers is a co-founder of Blue Startups. He's Blue Planet and Tetris fame. You also get some state funding. And what, in your view, can Hawaii do to attract more cross-border investment to really, again, in that area of tech development particularly,
right,
help itself?
Well, yeah, I mean, you mentioned the state funding that we do get, which has been critical to our development, critical both to our beginning and to our continued existence. We get funding from the Hawaii Strategic Development Corporation. We also get funding from the Hawaii Technology Development Corporation, both of which are critical for our operations. We think both programs are very successful and need to continue to get support from the legislature and from the governor. And
do you
hopefully
feel that
will
support?
Happen.
Do you?
I think that it's hard for our policymakers to look long term, right? And that's a chronic political issue
and a universal one.
Yes. Universal one. So because this is not a quick fix type of situation, we are planting seeds, and those seeds are growing, but it takes time. We need to stay the course and continue to support those efforts. And we're not the only one that benefits, right? There are now six active accelerators in Hawaii, and they all benefit from these programs and other programs that are being offered by the University of Hawaii, for example. City and County has gotten involved on the Big Island. So there are other funders involved in these programs, but it is really critical that we are able to continue with these programs so that we can see them bear fruit, because these are startup companies. So they're starting from scratch. It takes
That's
a
true.
Long time for them to get to the amount of traction that they would need to really be a big employer in town.
And to be on their own. Briefly, if you could write a law, change a law, or influence state spending,
right,
what would you do?
That is always a really tough question. I do think the two things that the state is doing currently are both important. One is capital formation. So it is providing seed funding and investment dollars that do have to be matched privately. That's the HSDC program, but it is important to have that seed, right, so that you can attract the private capital. And the other is in operating grant capital. So that supports these types of programs through grant funding. And again, it's very hard to run these programs on their own without some kind of grant funding. I'm sure there are a million other things we could be doing. But, you know,
a lot of that starts with funding, though.
That's right.
Chanel Farnsworth, managing partner of Blue Startups, the group behind this week's East Meets West conference, gets underway tomorrow. You can find out more about that, eastmeetswest.co or bluestartups.com.
If you make the transition to a sustaining membership at whatever level that is, you feel differently about your radio station. You take greater pride in it, and you really get a greater sense of the cooperative nature of the people that you're sharing the responsibilities and the gifts of public radio with. I'm Suzanne, and I'm a sustaining member of Hawaii Public Radio.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Now, what would a Hawaii kitchen be without shoyu? It's the go-to seasoning for locals to marinate chicken, flavor poke, dribble over a bowl of rice, million things to do with it. Yet the same love of the sauce divides us as well as unites us, because as you know, it's not just about shoyu, but what brand of shoyu gets your loyalty. In Hawaii, it's been a long-held debate between two camps, one representing a local producer in Kalihi on Oahu, the other from Noda, Japan. Now, whether your tastes lean towards the tangy and salty or the sweet and mild, one brand may have a stronger appeal over the other for you. Easy quiz today. Can you name the two shoyu contenders vying for a place on your plate? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 from Neighbor Islands if you know the answer. First one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Kahilu Theater on Hawaii Island, presenting South African solo classical guitarist Derek Gripper, performing music of Bach, Malian Kora music, and more this Friday. KahiluTheater.org.
Our next guest this morning is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and New York Times best-selling author who's delivering a free public lecture tonight at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. It's called Confessions of an Enemy of the People, Media in the Age of Trump. He's Ellis Hennekin, and full disclosure, he's a classmate of mine from many years ago at Columbia University School of Journalism. Ellis, aloha, welcome, and hey, media in the age of Trump, what's your lead, buddy?
Well, first of all, it's nice to know that we're both still standing.
Yes,
that's the real good news. But as we are here, we have a president who, as you know, is unlike any president we've ever had before, and that has brought up a whole series of challenges for the media. Mm. And some of them we've responded well to. I think some of them we've flubbed, and we're going to talk about that tonight.
And one of the unfair questions of where does this go from here? We're 2 years in now, mm-hmm. into a 4-year term. What do you watch for? I mean, let's take, for example, the recent government shutdown, and perhaps it's the once in future government shutdown. What do you take out of that that gives any indication of where we go?
Well, you can almost not imagine a similar set of events with any other president, right? And part of it, right at the core of it, I think, was Donald Trump's feeling that, you know, it doesn't really matter what how people feel about it. People can criticize him. Everyone can say, including many of his closest advisors, said, hey, this is a crazy idea. It's cruel. It's not going to get you what you want. If you really want a wall, this is not the best way to get there, and real people are suffering. But he is uniquely able to withstand that kind of criticism. In fact, I think he sort of delights in it. He's a disruptor, and he likes disrupting stuff. And so those are the results we get.
What is the danger for journalists in terms of getting inured to something, to many aspects of the Donald Trump presidency?
Well, to us, it's like crack, right? It's so interesting, so crazy, so wild. The ratings are terrific, right? We're all selling more newspapers and getting better TV ratings than we've gotten in years. And so the tendency that we all have is to run toward the light, right? Run to the explosion. And I am not saying that we ought to pretend he's not there or that we ought to not cover stuff that's important. But Bill, I do think it's important that the media be savvy about this stuff, that we correct the misstatements of facts as they are being made, that we don't simply deliver the carnival and say, oh, gee, isn't that fun? But we constantly, over and over again, point out, hey, there are consequences to this. Here's who may be suffering here. Here's how our relationships with our allies are being strained, and on. So I don't think the answer is to turn our heads away, but the answer is to be very smart and very aggressive in the way we cover it.
Do you think there's been any increase in terms of the media's self-awareness about being used by Donald Trump?
Yeah. We constantly wrestle with that, and I think newsrooms across the country, including here, I'm sure, because, you know, he's really good at it. And he has brought some skills to bear that most politicians don't have, right? We've never elected anybody this famous as president.
And media savvy.
Super savvy,
in a sense of wanting to produce his own show.
Absolutely. And he has some native gifts for that. Add social media to the equation, which is a way for politicians to communicate with their base without the media, going around the media. And those tools, also, just as, and I don't know how to say this in a nice way, so I'm not going to try, but his willingness to lie, right? To say things that aren't true, to stick with him in the face of contrary evidence, and say, hey, so what? You don't believe me. You say terrorists aren't coming across the border. I say they are. Now there you go.
And disputing even to his intelligence officials as recently as this morning.
But
one area that close to the heart here in Hawaii, and I know from your hometown in New Orleans, climate change.
Yeah.
And the idea that no, pay no attention to this. It's not as important. I mean, how does that? How's the media deal with that?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's aimed at everybody. I mean, he and frankly, the climate change deniers haven't won a lot of new converts. I think it's really aimed at keeping the base together. And so what those of us who cover this stuff and talk about it in a public way need to just keep coming back and saying, hey, here's the science. Here's the fact. I know these people are saying this thing, but here's the reality of it. And frankly, I think there's some minds we won't change. I mean, we're a very tribal country, right? And it's, you know, I do this pundit stuff all the time, and I love it. I love the debate part of it. I enjoy, you know, arguing with the skinny blonde women on Fox. I mean, I like all of that stuff. But I have to tell you, I don't think any of us are changing that many minds. I mean, I think it isn't really very easy today to convince a Trump lover that they ought to hate the guy. And conversely, someone who is not fond of the president, I don't think there's much you could say that would turn that opinion around.
At some point, you do hope that the facts come into the story.
We hope.
Though,
we can hope. Show me the evidence, but I'm still hoping.
You know, at the risk of going away from Donald Trump for a while, I know years ago, I lived in New York. You wrote a subway column in New York, and living in the city and being quite annoyed with the subway system quite often, I imagine there are experiences, maybe lessons from that inform other parts of your professional life.
Well, yeah, sure. One of them is go there as a reporter. You know, it's easy as we get on to just kind of opine from the sidelines. But when you go there, you learn stuff. And I mean, you know that from years of reporting all around the world. that there is no substitute for going and seeing somebody or showing up at the event.
Talking to folks.
Walking down the street and climbing the stairs. And that was...
Smell the air.
Yeah.
Shoe leather reporter.
That certainly qualifies. Also, find things that all people relate to. The subway in New York is a great example. Whatever neighborhood you live in, the subway is in some ways your neighborhood. And if you're in Honolulu, there are places that all people feel a connection to. Yeah. And seeing how they're doing is really important, I think.
I'd put the ocean, the land, and the sky among some of the things that connect
us. You got some good ones here. Let's admit it.
You know, you covered a horrible subway derailment in New York City. This is Union Square in 1991. Five people were killed. It was the deadliest subway crash in New York since 1928. The motorman was drunk. Mm-hmm. You and your team at Newsday won a Pulitzer for your coverage. Mm-hmm. I was living in New York at the time. I remember that really ripped at the heart of the city because everybody uses the subway and could see themselves in that horror.
Right, I've ridden that train. I could have been there.
Exactly. Yeah. I've been at Union State. I know that stop. You know, we had a terrible tragedy this week in Honolulu.
Yeah, I saw that.
Three pedestrians killed, others badly hurt in a neighborhood called Kaka'ako. Drunk driver. Mm-hmm. Many people in town can see themselves or loved ones in that, and I felt sort of a tremor of that, of pedestrians that could have been there on a random weeknight. What from your experience of that horrible subway crash there, what did it take to heal from that? Any insights for here?
Well, one or two, yeah. First of all, let's acknowledge that fear is rational. Right? I mean, it is unlikely, given the number of people who live here, that any one person is going to be affected by that. Statistics are our friend in a way. But people aren't crazy to feel like that. So let's start with that. And then let's start thinking about, you know, are there better ways using public policy, using engineering, using the smart folks who are at the university and elsewhere to try and come up with better answers to that? The question of drunk driving and people behind the wheel who are impaired is something that I think we've gotten smarter about, right? When we were kids, people didn't take that as seriously. But it really is important, I think, to come together, acknowledge the danger, and say, hey, you know, how can we do this in a way that is more humane and still lets us get around as we need to for our lives and our economy? And, you know, we don't all want to sit at home every day.
Yeah, live our lives. You know, you also co-write books these days.
Yeah,
you've
it's a fun thing.
And you got one out this week that you've collaborated on or written with. Former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. It's called Let Me Finish, Trump, the Kushner's Ban in New Jersey and the Power of In-Your-Face Politics. Number one, welcome to Hawaii, which is not quite in-your-face politics. But what was it like working on that book and in these books generally?
I know you're thinking those are strange bedfellows, Christie and me, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And you know, in a way, that's true. I mean, our political outlooks may not be perfectly congruent, to use a little understatement. But I love a great story. He's an interesting guy. He's had a phenomenal journey. And frankly, he's one of the very few Trump insiders who's cocky enough to tell you the truth. And so there's a lot of fascinating personal stuff in there, and the book's doing great. And I'm actually kind of proud of it.
And you've also done work with Dwight Gooden, Ray Kelly, former New York police commissioner, a lot of these. What's that like in terms of helping to tell somebody else's story?
Well, you know, it's different from most of the journalism I've done, which has often been about my point of view and my opinion. These are storytelling exercises. This is like me being a kid with my four brothers and sisters and my folks sitting at the table on Jefferson Avenue in New Orleans telling stories at dinner, half of which more or less were true. Right? Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, but that's how we learn is with stories, right? Arguments don't convince anybody of anything. Statistics don't. But those stories, boy, if you can tell them right, they really are how we connect as people.
Power of storytelling, power of talk story. Ellis, thanks so much for coming in.
Hey, what a nice treat.
What a great treat for us. Ellis Hanekin, journalist, author, pundit, also the voice of Stormy on Cartoon Network C-Lab 2021. He'll be talking tonight at UH Manoa on Confessions of an Enemy of the People, Media in the Age of Trump. 7 p.m. in the Architecture Auditorium, and it's free. It's now time for the reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. The politics are not over at the Honolulu City Council, and for that matter, neither is the election. Trevor Azao and Tommy Waters will face off in April. Joining us with more on that story, Chad Blair. Chad, pretty unusual situation here.
You know, I can't remember. I've been covering politics a long time here, Bill. I cannot remember a rematch, a runoff, if you will, a runoff of a runoff, for that matter.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely right. This is for Honolulu City Council District 4. That's a huge area. Stretches from Hawaii Kai well through the Ala Moana area. About 66,000 voters in total are registered in that district. And you're right, it's April 13th, a Saturday. Gosh, you got to wonder how much interest. But this is another thing. This is a mail-in vote. There will be early walk-in at Honolulu Hale at City Hall. You can do that. But this is going to be through the mail primarily. And one hopes everyone gets their ballots in on time, right? Because that's what held up this whole recount business, or led to the recount call, the fact that ballots were included after the 6 p.m. deadline back on general election night.
And, you know, it's interesting, Chad, you talk about mail-in voting. And we've seen certainly Kauai, which by the way, I was surprised to read in Anita Hofschneider's column that this district has more voters than registered voters than Kauai does.
Yeah, less than Maui, but more than Kauai. I mean, it does show you how significant this is. And really, for all intents and purposes, voters in that district have been disenfranchised. They do not currently have representation. There are only 8 council members seated, not 9. Trevor Ozawa, of course, was expecting to be reseated and even become chair. And there's another twist in this whole thing. Ann Kobayashi, she's leading the council in the interim period. The council's actually going to pick someone to fill the district for Puka, if you will. They're going to decide that on Monday. They've asked people to apply. Obviously, you got to live in the district and be registered to vote there. But they will be putting somebody in the seat. The council hasn't been able to do much business, including dealing with all those vacation rentals and so forth. Budget hearings will be coming up later. So they got to get somebody in that seat now, not wait until April the 13th.
And, you know, Chad, this also sets up an interesting dynamic, as you have long observed and written about, but when it comes to support of Mayor Caldwell or non-support of Mayor Caldwell or active non-support of Mayor Caldwell, there's a real sort of shift within
There's no secret, Bill, that Kirk Caldwell, the mayor, would like Tommy Waters, someone that he served with back in the legislature, to be on the council. While Waters says that he and the mayor don't agree on everything, there's just 9 people on that council. You need 5 in order to run the place. And Ozawa is aligned with a faction of 4 others that are less inclined to go along with the mayor. Should Waters win this race, that will help Caldwell. Should Ozawa win, that will hurt Caldwell. A lot at stake, particularly as the rail project enters, to put it mildly, a very interesting chapter, right? We're trying to get that last section lined up to Ala Moana Center.
And that, you know, part of this in terms of the vote itself, and it's interesting, over the weekend I saw sign waivers out already. But so much, as with any election anywhere, but particularly in Hawaii, turning on that, on the voter turnout issue, any sense of how that may go? Does mail-in help that? I don't know. Any indications?
Two things I would say. Special elections generally do not attract anywhere near the number of voters. We have low voter turnout anyway for primary and general contest. I'm thinking of the special election back in 2010. That's when Neil Abercrombie left Congress to run for governor. You had Charles DeJoux and Ed Case and Colleen Hanabusa run for that race. But the numbers go down, and that definitely is the case on a special election in general. Another thing, though, to look at it from another point of view, absentee voting is increasing. More people vote by mail than actually walk in. It's been that way for the last couple of elections, and that's something I will be looking at. Literally, a ballot's going to come to your house. You can just fill it in and send it in, and if you don't want to, you can still go down to Honolulu Hale. So it will be test. The state, by the way, is looking at having all mail-in voting statewide. Kauai's next year, but they're actually looking at maybe statewide by 2022 or so.
All right. Well, in the meantime, we'll keep an eye on the calendar in April.
We sure will.
Great. Thanks, Chad. Political and opinion editor at Civil Beat, Chad Blair, with today's reality check. You can read that full story by Anita Hofschneider, by the way, at civilbeat.org. Immigration has been part of this country's story since before its beginning. And of course, aspects of it dominate parts of the current national political debate. But there are smaller stories of immigration, millions of them, and some paint a much broader picture. HPR contributing editor Neil Milner is here with one of them this morning in his segment, The Long View. And Neil, the story starts in the former steel town of Youngstown, Ohio.
And I see it as more textured than broader, really, as the power of
a
single story. Yeah. And to me, what's really fascinating about this is that it tells you things about immigration that the broader messages tend to ignore. And not saying that this story is typical, but it's a very useful one. And it involves various settings and cast of characters. It involves Youngstown, which is one of the most depressed economically cities in the country. Youngstown, Ohio is kind of the worst of the rust belts. It involves one particular immigrant who is about to be deported, whom the town turns around and supports very strongly. And we'll get to why. It involves the last place that he spent time in jail, in prison, before he was deported, that it's a prison for people who are about immigrants who are about to be deported. It's in right outside of Youngstown, Ohio. And in fact, the politicians in Youngstown, Ohio were very happy when that prison reopened and began to flourish because it creates jobs. And then a kind of silent part of the story is the bunch of immigrants who don't receive the attention that this one particular immigrant, Amir Atman Aji, receives. So that's the cast. So real quickly, the story is this. Aji is a Jordanian immigrant who comes to the country legally to the U.S. in 1979. Down the road, he gets married to an American woman. He gets his green card. And later on, he divorces her, remarries, raises a family here. He raises a family here and opens up a convenience store, which is a very common immigrant kind of thing, in an area of Youngstown that no one else would open businesses in. You can imagine what it looked like. It's tremendously successful. The town is very proud of it. 60 people work for him. So that's the good news. Then the immigration people step in and charge him with fraud, that it was his first marriage was a green card marriage. His wife, his first wife, says she was forced to sign papers, not in his behalf, but that the feds made her take. Whatever case, Aji loses and fights it for a long time. And then he comes to be deported. They put him in jail while he's waiting for the couple of months. So you have a very successful business person that the town really was proud of. It showed some optimism. So what happens? The town comes out and supports him. The politicians support him. He gets deported, but he's seen as an immigrant that we were really proud of.
Local hero.
Then the article points out that, okay, but let's remember where he was. He was in an immigrant deportation prison that contains a whole lot of people like Aji who are not that well known from the town. It isn't that the town had anything against these others, but that because Adi's story is such a compelling story of economic success, that receives a lot of visibility.
Right.
The town politicians thought in terms of economic success. That's why the prison is there. Prisons create jobs for people. Low-paying jobs, but jobs. They also create a population that gets counted in the census, and that increases the size of your place and more likely to get money. So what they point out here, this is not really an article condemning the town, but what they point out here is how the story of economic success is so important for for Adi. There's nothing here about anti-Muslim sentiment, about fear of terrorism. And the politicians in that town say things like, we need immigrants. But the many immigrants, including ones that were picked up in raids, that were in situations like Adi, but not the story of economic success, it's not like they're condemned. It's like they're not talked about. And as your last guest pointed out about the power of storytelling, whose story gets told becomes a very important factor.
You know, another important part of that is the idea of personalizing something versus the idea of, oh, it's those, it's, it, again, the theyism, the splitting off to the others. You know, Adi, we know he's one of us. That's different, but there's not that degree of empathy in the abstract.
You know what it made me think of when I read this? The stories of people in pain. If you read stuff that medical sociologists or writer people communications, they always talk about the things that influence us most about health and illness is personal stories of people in pain, not stories about cancer rates and so on. And you notice how powerful those are. If you think of the many fundraising and crowdsourcing and whatever else, kickstarting to raise money for a person with cancer. One way to react to that, and I always react this way, is to say, what a terrible medical system we have that you have to go outside to raise it. But the point is, it's a personal story that we can relate to, and it moves people forward. And of course, you have a president who knows how to do this, however much of the stories are false. He's a very good storyteller. And that's what this is, to me, was really like, that Adi becomes a person that literally the town knew. And it was a compelling story about economic success. And so you had a person really in pain here. He's back in Jordan with his wife, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So despite the local support.
He's gone.
Deportation took place. Yeah. You know, talking about those personal stories and the president, it takes me forward to, I'm going to make a bold prediction in terms of next week.
You're in the right place.
Yeah. State of the Union address. We're going to have some of those personal stories. Every president does it, but you know that immigration is going to be a topic here, and there's going to be a camera shot of somebody in the crowd, and it's going to be, I'm imagining, that something related to the wall, and this is why a wall is needed. You may also, in the Democratic response, you may also have a different story of immigration, again, with that personalized sense, but that importance of personalizing stories.
Bold prediction. Oh, for sure. I mean, this is what the president is going with now. This is an issue that polarizes the political parties more than any other issue is immigration. He's certainly going to stage something, and he's not the first one to stage it, that he's going to tell a story about whether it's about MS or, you know, the gangs in Long Island or his usual immigrant stories, and he's going to have someone in the crowd that he puts there, as all presidents do. And for sure, it's going to be like that. The real problem with storytelling as a form of political analysis, I don't mean the kind of stuff I do, the kind of stuff we all do, is that our brain is wired, it literally is, and we know this from research, to accept the power of individual stories. But an individual story is not a story that's necessarily typical. Right. And we use our confirmation biases to pretend as if it is. And so that becomes the story. I'm not sympathetic, for example, to Trump's wanting to build the wall. So when I read this story about Adi, I understand the power here. But I don't want to make any general claims that this is how people, you know, that there isn't anything in here about resentment or anything like that. So it's a good example of what a story can do and what a story can't do. It gives you texture. It gives you depth. But it doesn't give you breadth.
No universal answer, but as you say, a little texture to that.
Texture. I used it twice, yes.
Neil, thanks so much for
joining us. You're welcome.
Neil Milner, retired professor of political science and contributing editor of our segment, The Long View. You can find out more on our Facebook page, The Conversation HPR.
find HPR's on-air membership drives exciting? Would you excel at coordinating station events to engage our community? We're looking for a pledge and listener experience producer with at least 3 years of work experience managing cross-functioning teams. Applications are due by the end of day tomorrow, so check out the Employment Opportunities page on the HPR website today.
Although shoyu's origins are in Japan, the seasoning's become a big part of local cuisine. Its ubiquitous use in local dishes gives a clue about just how much we've adopted it. From shoyu chicken to shoyu spam musubi, it's really the state condiment of Hawaii. Doesn't mean we all agree about the brand of shoyu. For some, palate appeal, major factor, others, application dictates which brand dominates. For the rest, it's principle. In the islands, two brands of shoyu stack up above the others. We asked you in today's quiz to name them. And according to some cooks, strong and tangy Kikkoman shoyu from Noda, Japan, is used more in cooking, while Aloha shoyu, made in Kalihi, has a milder sweet taste, often used as a sauce. So really, you don't have to choose. You can have both. And we had a winner on this, Susie Bon, Keaau on the Big Island. And I'm told our producer, Lillian Song, says this was a very popular quiz. The phones blew up. An informal survey, Aloha, squeaking ahead by one vote. I didn't get to vote on that. Susie likes Aloha on rice, Kikkoman to marinate chicken. A couple of listeners with their own ideas as well, including Bragg's amino acid. That's today's quiz. If you got one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Joby Rohr from Kahalu. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Sounds of the Lunar New Year there. HPR's Noe Tanigao here. She covers arts, culture, and ideas, more than a bit of each of those in Lunar New Year celebrations.
No,
in particular, Honolulu's Chinatown. Noe, you were saying this year, bit of a shift, bit of a difference.
Bit of a way back to having a celebration for New Year in Chinatown. Yes, it's happening again, Bill. You live right on the edge of Chinatown, so you know it makes a big difference to have things going on over there. I mean, this is the year of the pig coming up, the Earth Pig. You maybe don't know exactly what that means. I won't go into the horoscopes of it, but I will tell you that some famous pigs include Arnold Schwarzenegger, Hillary Clinton, Amy Winehouse, Henry VIII. So if you can draw any parallels between those people, you got the pig nailed. All right, with the Night in Chinatown coming back, Bill, though I was wondering how that neighborhood's been doing. Because last year, you know, the merchants were saying business was so down. And I noticed that there's something called the Chinatown Watch website's been started. So checking that thing out, what it is, it's sort of an anonymous way of gathering incidents that have happened in Chinatown, and there are a lot of them. Went in to talk to Oren Schliemann of Infographics. He's had an office in Chinatown for 30 years. First, he was over on Nu'uanu, and about 15 years ago, he bought the building that he's in now in a drug foreclosure.
Our building is at the corner of Pauahi and Mauna Kea. It's a historic building, obviously. And curiously enough, Changapana, who was the model for Charlie Chan, the most decorated and revered Honolulu police detective ever, had an office in this building. And his job back then was to find a way of fighting crime. He was this small, squiddly guy who would go up buildings, arrest people with a bullwhip. His most famous arrest was arresting of like 41 gamblers with a bullwhip, marched them down to the old police station on Bethel Street down there. So it's rather ironic that where you had on-the-ground officers there 24/7, in this day, the model they're currently using to police has a lot to do with vehicles. And I know Police Chief Ballard is in favor of community-based policing and having officers on the street. What I don't understand is why it's okay to have an unsafe neighborhood with plenty kupuna and plenty keiki going around all day in Honolulu.
It's quite a colorful, a colorful neighborhood in transition is what we're looking at. And Schliemann and his wife, Fran Butera, live on that corner. They've been living there for 13 years. They say that River of Life, the food kitchen, used to be able to handle their clients, but recently added services in the area have not concerned themselves as much with the ripple effects on the community. That's what Fran Butera says.
Communities where homeless people gather are profoundly affected by the fallout, by the garbage, by the fights, by the F-bombs, by the psychotic episodes, by the crime. Nobody's advocating for us.
Is it getting worse?
This past year was off the charts in this neighborhood. Everything you need if you're going to be homeless and a substance abuser is right here on our block.
That stretch of Mauna Kea, also very bad.
Yeah, but it's a stretch that's a block down below Baratania, and they pointed out to me the various businesses where drugs are sold, and we watched a drug deal out of their window. You can see a lot of it on the Chinatown Watch website, but what really irks Schliemann, I'll tell you, is that 40% of the buildings in Chinatown are owned by the city. At any rate.
40%?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then when you include some of the public spaces, it could get up to about 60% of the properties in there. What he sees as a designer is, you know, potential. Anyway, they're both looking forward to Chinese New Year down there because it does bring more people into the neighborhood, including, you know, kids who go down there. I mean, you notice the difference on the street,
sure.
Right?
Sure. No, absolutely. And it's also, I mean, Chinatown is not that far from parts of downtown that are developing more quickly, that are on the upswing, definitely. But there's no question in terms of Lunar New Year celebrations sort of bringing a lift there.
I know. You get some of the red paper lanterns out.
Yeah.
And then there, just the other day when I was there were two gentlemen out on the street, you know, doing the calligraphy where they write you a calligraphy for your home for that year.
Right.
Things we need, aphorisms we need, you know, like strong as a horse and fearless as a dragon, that kind of thing, right? Well, these Chinatown merchants are working hard to stay where they are, but they're squeezed. Gifford Chang, head of the Chinatown Merchants Association, says our little Chinatown is changing.
Fish market's going to slowly disappear. Your produce market's going to slowly disappear. Or are they going to shrink in number of operators?
Chinese restaurants aren't even there as much anymore.
You're going to see a change in Chinese cooking. They call fusion, right? What they used to call chop suey is really going to be chop suey. It's just a taste. And it's just society trying something different, trying to deliver some good or service that the public's demanding.
I guess we learned not to take the night in Chinatown for granted.
There's been a lot of effort, a lot of love, a lot of people that saying thank you for bringing this back this year. Hopefully the appreciation grows more and the participation begins again. And hopefully we can cover expenses and make it all work. We thank again our wonderful sponsors with the city and HTA.
Well, the city and HTA came back. And that's what really is allowing it to happen, with a lot of help from the community elsewhere. But pretty much they were the people that made sure we had a night in Chinatown once again. And what it means is that Saturday is the day for Chinatown, 8 a.m. to 9:30 at night. They're going to be booths out on the streets. There'll be entertainment and stages. And there'll be a parade starting at 4:30 on Hotel Street from the state capitol. But, you know, over at the Chinatown Cultural Plaza, they'll be having events on Friday night and on Saturday night as well.
Lion dances, always a chance to pop a little money in the mouth for good
that's
luck
right.
for the coming
Did you ever
year.
Wonder what to do when that thing came up to you, Bill?
It's a little sort of hesitation of, you know, you want to get the timing right. And sometimes, especially if there's a little kid inside, you want to have them get the credit for it as opposed to
right.
the old pros done that for years. But
exactly. Well, those lion dances, you know, are a way for kids to grow up in the culture.
And that's the whole thing. Again, you know, so much around Hawaii, you look to windows into culture. And for those also who are not steeped in it, who are not used to it, but just want an introduction. And help me understand more about this. It's a great way to get into that as well for Chinatown and for the Lunar New Year. You know, people always call it the Chinese New Year, which is true, but the Lunar New Year too. It's Tet in Vietnam. It's celebrated all across the region.
So many cultures represented right there in our Chinatown.
Absolutely. Noe, thanks so much.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. HBR's Noe Tanigawa is covering arts, culture, ideas. You can hear her stories. You can find her stories on our website at hawaiipublicradio.org. You're not going to get music like that on AM radio. That's it for the conversation today. Catherine's back tomorrow. Among the stories she'll be talking about, drones and first responders, how artificial intelligence can help, plus an update on how Kukua Market's doing in its struggle to survive and thrive. Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line. Leave us a comment in your voice. The number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation, Twitter at HI Conversation. If you missed any of this show or want a past one, you can find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under HPR News and Talk for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Bill Dorman. Join us tomorrow for The Conversation.